Some people say that my speeches are sometimes somewhat fractured, but this is ridiculous, you know. anyway, of course, I broke my arm Sunday and was tripping on some ice in Toronto, which is interesting, and it's a metaphor for something. It's on my way to give a speech to a group of Rabbanim, and I have some good stories, but I'll control myself. I was asked to speak about marriage, and there are three points I was going to focus on in the half hour or so that I was asked to speak. It's very interesting. I wasn't going to say this, but the Gemara at the end of Sukkah, so nice to be able to speak at a Sudas Mitzvah and speak at a Siyam, where it talks about you could tell the child from his parents, right? And, you know, if I understood the Gemara, that's what the Gemara meant, right? It's talking about the impact of what you hear from a child. Is that right? Is that the pshat in that last Gemara? Basically, right? It's the impact of parenting on a child. What you hear from a child's lips is reflective of the parents. That's shipua. Is that the pshat? Am I getting it right? Good, okay. So I just wanted to make sure. So there's been some new research. I don't know if any of you read the new book by Daniel Kahneman, Soponovich Rebbe's nephew. It's one of the top 10 notable books on the New York Times list this year, and it's been on the bestseller list for some time now. It's a brilliant book. He's a Nobel laureate in economics, although he's a psychologist. And it's a fascinating book. It's called Think Fast, Think Slow. I think that's the title. And one of the things he talks about in the book is something called priming. And as I heard that Gemara, I was thinking about Dr. Kahneman's theories. He doesn't apply it to parenting, but I think it's something that we have to be so careful about because it's often very subtle the way we impact on our children. Here's what he says. He's talking about a series of research studies that he and his colleague, Dr. Tversky, did together that won them the Nobel Prize. And among them is, let's say we divided this group into tables. Okay, so we had this table, all the tables in this room. And we gave you five seemingly unrelated words to commit to memory. Okay? And it was just part of a game, a Malava Malka game, part of our program. And let's say one table, without you knowing what this was about, your five words were the following: Florida, wrinkled, bald, shuffleboard, I don't know.
Golf.
Good. Okay. I like that. Okay. And then we served dessert and we timed how long it would take you, correcting for the distance of the tables, to get to the dessert table. Turns out the table that got the old people words, it would take you between 2 and 3 times longer to get to the dessert table. But the amazing thing is, you wouldn't know it. It would be totally unconscious. Totally unconscious. You may not have even made the connection of those five words to being old people words. But that's how subtly the environment impacts on our thoughts and actions and behaviors. And it's a kal v'chomer with parenting. The Gemara is talking about basically what Dr. Kahneman was saying in terms of priming. And we prime all the time. We prime in our connections to each other. And that's the first point I wanted to talk about, is in marriage, all the new research is showing that one of the key ingredients to nourishing a marriage is being able to fulfill what we just read this morning in the Parsha, which is the model of a Jewish marriage, which is basically what the Kruvim are, right? wings pointing upward in terms of our vision and our dreams and striving towards our, together as a couple in the Bein Adam L'Makom, but also Pneihem, our faces, the faces of the Kruvim, they were looking at each other, eye to eye, face to face, hearts bouncing off each other. And that, in a way, is the key. But let me develop this in a more specific way. Here's what the research shows. It's so subtle, the things that happen. After you're married for a while, and the initial passion is gone, okay? So let's say you're past that, and you've been married, and you already have, you know, Liai and Hara, young children, and you're going through the stress, the financial pressures. You know what's extremely important? Things that you have no idea are important. It's the invisible lessons that we give to our children as we sit around a Friday night table or Shabbos afternoon table talking to our friends, what our kids hear. But even more important, it's are we turning towards each other when we're having what seems to be innocuous, silly conversation. So you're sitting down at a breakfast table and the husband is reading the paper, and his wife is talking about something from the day before, and you sort of turn away. You sort of say, uh-huh, yes, dear, yes, honey, and you're not really listening. It turns out that in the research, when you become distracted that way, and you go on automatic pilot because you're not even aware of it necessarily, it turns out that when you do that, it is the beginning of what could start to be a problem in a marriage. Marriages need to be nourished by turning towards. They need to be nourished by eye to eye, face to face, heart to heart. And without that, it's very easy to lose track of the shared vision and dream. Early on, it's easy to know. You know what your wife's dreams are, your wives know what their husband's dreams are, and it's not hard at all. But as life takes over, unless you deliberately push yourself, there's that nekudas habechira, that point of choice where you push yourself to turn towards your spouse and really show interest. Even though you may be faking it a little bit, even though you're overwhelmed, you just came home from work and you want to be reading the paper, you want to be relaxing, you want to be watching that game on TV, you know, the football game, or whatever it might be, or now basketball game, whatever it might be, you have to get off automatic pilot, okay? Viktor Frankl said it best. He said, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our growth. In that space lies our choice. That's the kudas habechira. Your wife's talking to you. You could continue to go and go back to the paper or check your email or do any of those things. But you have to understand that seemingly insignificant turning away has huge costs. And the simple task of turning towards and saying there's nothing more important in my life now than the turning towards. Nothing more important than listening and hearing and sharing. It doesn't mean there aren't going to be times that it's fine to do that, but to at least make sure that there are times that you reconnect for the shared vision and the shared dream. I'm going to talk a little bit about this guy over here, okay? So you probably guessed already is what I'm going towards, and I'm not going to preach. You know, it's very interesting. There's a beautiful thought from Rav Asher Weiss that I came across recently, where he talks about the Gemara. I think it's in Bava Metzia, is it? It's one where they talk about Sinai. How is the Har HaBayis viewed? So, right, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov each had a different metaphor that the Torah uses for talking about the way they viewed and related to the Har HaBayis, right? So it's either viewed as a mountain, or it's viewed as a field, or in the case of Yaakov, it's viewed as a bias, as a house. It's viewed as a house. And in fact, the Gemara tells us there that we view it as a house. We view it as a house. So Rav Asher Weiss says, what's that really? What's the symbolism? That the symbolism is that a house, in our relationship to the outside world, we're open to it. We have windows, it has doors, but we also have walls. And I was thinking that's very much part of what a marriage is about. You know, we let the outside world in, that's what this community is about. It's about letting the outside world in. But it's also about having walls. And in order to understand how to manage what this is doing to relationships, I was going to share with you a couple of things. Point one. Point one is this. Right? I'm talking to you like an old Jewish man, and I'm moving my hand. I only have one hand to move today. Okay? So as I go like this, if you had a picture of my brain, you would see that there's a dedicated motor neuron in the motor cortex of my brain that's going like this. Not surprising, it's the way the brain works. But here's what's surprising. In the last 5-6 years, neuroscientists have discovered an amazing thing. As I go like this, and you guys all look at me, you have a corresponding neuron in the motor cortex of your brain, and guess what it's doing? It's going like this. Meaning we're hardwired for empathy. We're hardwired for deep connection. We're hardwired to be nosei ba'ol im chaveiro. We're hardwired for that kind of connection. But it's only through the visual cortex. It's not when we're looking down texting. It's not when we're engaging in email voice. You know what email voice is? Is you're on the phone with your husband, with your wife, with your parents, with a friend, and you listen to them and you realize they're talking to you. They're there, but they're not really there. They seem distracted. Why? They're checking their email. That's email voice. Okay? That's not real human interaction. Real human interaction is about the face-to-face. Again, think of the Kruvim. Okay? Eye-to-eye, heart-to-heart, face-to-face. That's the essence. That's when the mirror neurons fire, when the connections go. And that is, according to every research study on building marriages and on parenting, it's the key. The key is to at least part of the time to be really present. You're not going to be that way all the time, but you have to make sure that with each of your children, as well as with yourselves and nourishing your shared vision and dream, that you have that going on. You know, it's interesting. I'll just finish this first ingredient with a couple of points. Point number one is actually a story I heard after I gave a talk in Yerushalayim where I was talking about some of these issues. Somebody came over to me, and he was his best friend was the son of Rav Bloch. That was what the first Rosh Yeshiva of Telz, before Rav Gifter, I think, in America. Extremely busy man. And his son didn't get to spend much time with him. But his son told the man who was telling me this story, evidently said that this is the way every morning of his childhood began, from age 6 or so till his bar mitzvah. His father would come into his bedroom about 6 o'clock in the morning, wearing his bathrobe, wearing his pajamas. They had a special bathrobe for this little boy that he put over his pajamas. They'd go into the kitchen before his father went off to Shacharis at Telz in Cleveland, and father and son would sit down for about an hour together and just have tea and milk. They'd share a cup of tea and milk. And the father, just Rav Bloch, would ask his son about his day before, the day that was coming. He would share with him a little bit about his life. And it cemented a relationship that totally buffered against the reality that as a Rosh Yeshiva of a growing powerhouse in Cleveland, that it would not get away from his showing that his number one priority was to spend time with the family. Is that amazing? The power of time makes all the difference. Okay, and really, I hate talking about quantity versus quality, but you know what? We know that he wasn't being interrupted by any outside kinds of distractions. There was no phone to ring. There was no email to check. There was no distraction whatsoever. So what that is about is stealing time. Last time I was here, I talked to you about the beautiful thought from the Kutzker. On Kachisim B'Yagibar Kein B'nei Hanurim, right? It says at the end of Tehillim, it talks about raising children. And it says, what's the connection between raising children and being an archer? And the Kutzker says, just like an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes. So too with raising children, the closer we hold them to our heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes. And that's why it's not surprising. Every night a week, the parents have dinner with their children. There's lower risk for drug abuse in their kids. And I'm going to say the obvious. It's worth saying. Please don't lose sight of your priorities. Part of the beauty of a community like this is I'm sure there are hardly any Shabbos afternoons or maybe Friday nights, but at least one meal a Shabbos I'm sure you're eating over with friends. But still, if it's at all possible, don't have a children's table. Have your kids sitting next to you. That's one of the main shaping factors of a kid's childhood. You have to be careful what you talk about around the table. You have to be careful what you expose them to. But have them with you at the table. Okay? And strongly consider having at least one Shabbos meal. I'm sure, I imagine most of you do this, where you don't have any company, where it's just the family. I just can't emphasize enough how crucial a force that kind of time is in shaping our children's childhood. Nothing is important. The more vacations a family takes with one-on-one, it's not a frill. The more likely that family is to do well when facing subsequent stresses in life. So that's the opening point is the power of time, the power of face-to-face, the power of trying to override. This is a wonderful, wonderful tool. But it also is the tool. It's a tool. We have to remember that we have to put it in its place. Okay? So that's part one. Continue the shared vision. Continue the shared dream. Find a way as a couple to steal time together, even if it's just going out one night a week for a cup of coffee. Whatever you could do. But make sure that you're continuing to check in with each other about what's most important to you. Where are you going? Where are you? What are you doing? What's important to you? Very easy to lose sight of that, and that's part one. Okay, we're good with that? Did I miss anything? Love map. Love map sounds like a little bit of a racy topic, but love map is what Dr. Gottman, who is one of the leading authorities in the world on marital therapy, talks about, which is the need for couples to build love maps, meaning to really understand what is important to their spouse by talking about it in a very methodical way. You know, to keep checking in on that. And that's an extremely important predictor of marital resilience. So that's part one. Part two is managing expectations. Let me talk about that a little bit. I've spoken in this neighborhood before about the U-shaped curve of marriages. So the U-shaped curve of marriages goes like this. Marriages in the firm world, we did a study with OU of about 4,000 marriages. It starts high. First 5 years or so, it's very high. Then marital satisfaction in most marriages in our community goes down. It hits its low point around the time that your kids are teenagers. Why? Because around the time that your kids are teenagers, you're pulled into the stress. High school yeshiva tuitions are getting higher and higher. To raise an adolescent in the secular world is about 2.5 times more expensive as raising an as they are when our children are younger. One of the local modern Orthodox yeshiva high schools across the bridge just raised their tuition to, I think, $32,000. So that's a lot of money. A lot of money. I don't know if they charge tuition here. Are they charging tuition in the local yeshivas here? In Bern? Yeah, I thought so. Okay. Okay. But I'm not saying that to get you nervous. Then there's the stress of parenting an adolescent. And all those things come together to bring the low point of marital satisfaction is the low point of the you is around when your kids are adolescents. Then, if you just stick it out, it keeps getting higher and higher and higher. And what you have to look forward to when you're married for as long as we've been, as Lani and I have been, Bliyai and Hara, is it goes above what it was at the beginning. So you have that to look forward to. We have to survive it. So it's all about managing expectations. But by the way, the U-shaped curve is universal. It's not just an Orthodox community. It's found in every study of marriage around the world, regardless of culture. It's just the way life works. But the key is to manage your expectations. Don't see it as surprising. That's what marriage is about. I often quote the Tiferes Yisrael and Yavamos on the word Nisuin that says that what's embedded in the word Nisuin is the idea that the inevitable fighting in a marriage, okay, either can be a masa, which is embedded in the word, which is a burden that weighs us down, or it could be a masa, which also means a song or a nevua, something transcendent that could pick us up in an incredibly inspiring way to be an engine of growth. And that's the key. That's the challenge. So the key is when the inevitable tensions happen, because again, that's what marriage is about. The key is to say, okay, this is what it's about. Did I tell you last time I was here the elevator example? Being on an elevator in Midtown Manhattan at 5 to 9 in the morning, right? You're on an elevator, the elevator's going up, it's extremely crowded, there's a guy behind you pushing into your back, extremely, extremely impatient to get out. And you're getting more and more angry at this guy, because he's invading your personal space, you know? And you want to give him a really dirty look when he finally gets off. Let's say you're getting off at the 45th floor, finally you get to the 34th floor and he's getting off, and you're going to give him a dirty look because it always makes you feel better, right? You know, you ever notice that on the highway when you look at somebody who's been driving you crazy? Like, it just makes you feel good. I don't know why. So you're ready to give him the look, you know, as if then he'll do total tshuva on his poor elevator behavior. And as you look back, you see he's blind. And what he was pushing into you with is his cane. Because he needed the cane in the crowded elevator to maintain his balance. You can't maintain your balance in a crowded elevator without a cane. What does that do to your emotional response? Your righteous indignation turns to empathy. Your sense of, rage, you know, gives way to maybe a little bit of shame. Okay? It's all about your perception. It's all about how you see it. So in terms of managing expectations, what I'm saying here is when there's inevitable conflict in a marriage, be it over whatever it is, the most common things that people fight about, we found in the OU study, was very common stuff, okay? Conflict over child rearing, which I'll get to in point three. Conflict over not enough time, communication, managing expectations. Dr. Sabalevsky and I were just members of a committee on a doctoral dissertation defense at Azrieli this week, where the results of a survey of over 2,000 marriages, I think about 2,500 marriages, were presented. And one of the things that now Dr. Maybrook, newly minted doctor as of Wednesday, found was she asked people a very simple question. You're dating now. I'm so sorry. You're finished with dating. You've been married for up to 10 years. And she measured their marital satisfaction. By the way, chasen kala classes really work and really help. That's for another talk. But one of the things that Dr. Maybrook asked is, What was very important to you when you were dating, and what's very important to you now that you have the wisdom of X amount of years of marriage? And what most people didn't realize was so important in marriage had to do with managing expectations. It had to do with bringing out the best in each other. Something psychologists now call self-expansion. You each want to make the other better. You want to be open to learning from each other. You don't marry your clone. You marry somebody who's a little different than you, but hopefully a little better than you in some areas. And that difference becomes a source. It can either become a source of a masa, of a burden, or it could be a source of a song pulling you up. It's up to you. It's all how you view it and how you deal with it. So that's point two. And I wanted to tie it to probably the most important expectation of all. And that's about a book came out last month. I don't know if anybody heard about it. It's called 30 Lessons for Living by somebody named Pillemer. Pillemer is a gerontologist at Cornell who did brilliant research on 1,000 old people. And listen to the brilliance of this study. He did it with the whole team. He goes to 1,000 old people, people in their 90s and their 80s and their 70s, and he asks them, give me advice. What have you learned about what matters and doesn't matter in life? And it was really empirically very well done, qualitative and quantitative study done with the gerontology team at Cornell. And he has a brilliant chapter on marriage. People who had been married, some of them for very, very long times, others who had been through marriage, divorce, remarriage. But he asked them, what really matters in marriage? It's a terrific chapter, and I'd recommend getting the book. It's called 30 Lessons for Living. Fresh out. You know, you could get it on Amazon if you have internet. If not, I have internet. I'll tell you. Okay? So I need it for my job. I need it for my job. You know, we sell it to, we rent, whatever. We rent it from a non-Jew. It's the whole thing. I have the whole heter. Anyway, so here's what Dr. Pillemer reports on marriage. It's the most frequent nugget of wisdom on marriage. Thank you. Thanks. By the way, I hope you're not listening to this. I don't want to get you nervous. Are you okay? Okay. This, by the way, remember, you have at least 5 years of marriage. And after that, we can take care of it. Don't worry. Can you imagine a guy who's not even getting married to Lotva Omer? Okay? It's good for him. It's good, right, Jay? Yeah, it's, you know, you'll be ready on that elevator. So, here's what's number one. In terms of the collected wisdom of 1,000 older people. They say, marry your best friend. And if you didn't marry your best friend, make them your best friend. But here's the key point. They say you have to go into marriage not thinking that it's 50-50. Marriage is not 50-50. Marriage is 100-100. When you wake up in the morning, you have to think about how am I going to give 100% of my efforts to trying to do stuff for my spouse. Right? That's the lesson of this week's parsha and of the coming parshios, right? It's v'yikhu, right? It's the giving. It's we get by giving. And it's that 100-100 where we're not keeping score. We're just doing everything we can for the other. That's the building block of love. It's the ahava-hav connection that Rav Dessler always talks about. And I just can't emphasize enough how extremely important that is. Now, we read this morning about the Bria HaTichon, right? The center pillar of the Mishkan was made out of what? The Medrash tells us. It was the tree that Avram sat under to welcome guests. Okay, that famous tree. The emblem for all time of chesed, of giving. And it was then floated down to where it could be built in to become the center pillar of the Mishkan. And obviously that's a metaphor. It's emblematic of how the cornerstone of Judaism and of parenting and of marriage is about chesed. It's about the giving. And the more you do that and make that the cornerstone of your marriage, the happier that marriage will be. And the more we teach our children to do it. I'll tell you a quick story. I mentioned this last night. And it was interesting to see the responses. I gave a talk in Great Neck last night. And I didn't mean it to be critical at all. It's where I live. But I saw from the responses of the people in the audience that I was definitely hitting something close to people's hearts. The research shows the more we require that our children do chesed, the less risk they will have for developing different kinds of psychological problems, such as depression. Okay, the more we require them, without overburdening them, to pay it forward, the better it's going to be for them. It's just, it's a key ingredient of resilience and of mensch-making. So I mentioned that I was asked to go to Sharon, Massachusetts a couple of months ago. I was asked to talk to the adolescents in the community there about some mild problem they were having. But the thing that hit me that was unbelievable was that they had a bigger turnout than they expected. So we had to move into a bigger room. And the parents weren't going to come for a couple of hours. So I had a couple of hours with all of these teenagers who I'd never met before. So I said, kids, do you have a bigger room for us to go in? And they said, sure, we'll take care of it. And en masse, all these kids, about 60 adolescents, go into the gym of the Young Israel there. They set up a circle of enough chairs for everybody. And we had a wonderful talk where it was very clear that these are kids who are not entitled, they have the right kind of values. But then, when we finished talking, I was concerned about how to leave the room the way I found it, so I figured maybe I have to find a custodian or something like that. Without me saying a word, every single kid spontaneously picked up their chair, put their chairs back exactly the way we found it, and we're sure to shut off the lights so nobody would have known we even used the room. Simple thing, but it's so important. Do we require that our children do chesed? If they're doing chesed just to service learning to get into a good college, it doesn't count. It has to be part of the DNA, the Briach HaTichon of our own Mikdash Ma'at. We have to just remember that. It's extremely, extremely important. So that's point two, manage your expectations. Marriage is not 50-50, it's 100-100. And to remember that part of that is the message of chesed, of anatnu, when you give, you get back. And the final point, I've been going on. I'm sorry, I apologize. Okay, let me just end then with, I'll wrap it up. Did a study recently with some... another doctoral student at Azrieli, where we looked at what are some risks in the Baal Tshuva community for having children with problems. And this doctoral student compared about 250 people who were from birth to 250 people who were Baal Tshuva, looked at what were the risks for problems in their kids, and found out that the number one risk factor in the Baal Tshuva community is the same risk factor for kids having problems in the from birth community. Know what it was? Conflict in front of children. Okay? We have to get on the same page in terms of our philosophies of child rearing. No husband and wife are going to have exactly the same child rearing philosophy. But there's a brilliant three words in Sefer HaChassidim. Here's the three words, which, you know, it's funny how three words could capture everything. Achris ketata charata. After a fight, there is regret. Quite a brilliant synopsis of this part. What this doctoral student found was that when couples were able to iron out their inevitable differences about religious differences in terms of philosophy of child rearing, when they were able to instead quietly deal with it to see if they could get more or less on the same page, then the kids were much more likely to turn out fine than those who fought about it in front of their kids. I just can't emphasize enough how important it is to do that. And let me end with a story on a fourth and final point. Point four. It has to do with maybe the common theme of the three points I've been talking about, which is the need to focus on the positive and to capture the uniqueness of what you want for your family, what's the bumper sticker you want your children to be raised by, and how to focus on being mevater, not holding on to anger, focus on the positive, saying to yourself over and over again, it's not important, it's not important, it's not important, not giving in right away to your anger, letting it ride, all those things. Think about what you and your spouse were fighting about last year at this time. Do you even remember? I imagine if I held a gun to your heads, very few of you would be able to remember what exactly the points of tension were a year ago. Now, maybe you're fighting the same fight over and over again throughout your marriage. That would be pretty common. But the reality is, an individual fight is almost never worth it. Achras katata charata. And especially about children. You need to find time, as you're nourishing your vision and dream, to find time to talk about it. It's fine to have different philosophies. You just have to work out so that you're sharing a common set of expectations of your children. And you have to learn how to focus on the positive. Here's what the bottom line is to realize the uniqueness of your spouse. Remind yourself deliberately what you fell in love with. You know what Dr. Gottman finds? If you deliberately focus on two or three traits of your husband or wife that you really admire, even though you want to kill them for other things, if you do that several times a week, it'll make for a better marriage. Deliberately. Remember, oh, you know, I love this about her. I love this about him. To do that and to hold on to it and to nurture the fondness and admiration that you have for each other is something that can make all the difference in the world. So I'm going to end, first of all, with, you probably heard this, but I just love it. I have this hung up on the wall in my office from Rav Kook. Hatzadikim hatahorim. Eino kovlim al harisha elamosif in sedek. This is all about the 100-100. They don't complain about evil. They only work on adding righteousness. Einam kovlim al hakfira elamosif in emuna. They don't complain about kfira. They only work on adding faith. They don't complain about foolishness. They only work on adding wisdom. Let me end with my concluding story. It's interesting because the anniversary of this story, I'm going to be at this organization tomorrow morning to give a talk. And it goes like this. Did I tell you this about... I don't think it happened when I was here last time, about the group of Satmar Hasidim trying to get me to come for Shabbos. I didn't talk about it. This group of Satmar Hasidim trying to get me and Lonnie to come spend Shabbos with them, mainly because it was a Shabbos of Chizuk. These were an organization dealing with kids with severe developmental disabilities, really severe challenges, okay? And it was a Shabbos of Chisuk. They wanted me to come to be their psychologist. And I could think of nothing I wanted less than spending Shabbos with a group of Samar Hasidim. Not that I don't love Samar Hasidim, some of my best friends, but it was just, it didn't feel like I'd be comfortable, didn't feel like it was fair to do to Lonnie. It just didn't feel right, you know. You know, I'm not exactly, I'm a modern guy. I'm a regular guy. You know? So, they finally wore me down. They called me every 3 months for 5 years. This is without exaggeration. And after the fifth year, I just couldn't say no anymore. So I decided to go. Of course, it became the high point of my, probably the best Shabbos that I had in a very long time. It's an unbelievable Shabbos. It's true, they viewed me as a modern guy. One of them referred to me as Chasidei Umo Sa'olam. Let me tell you what happened Friday night after the tish, and with this I'll sit down. Friday night, the tish is ending. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning. One of the chassidim says, you mind if I meet with you? Me and my wife would like to meet with you. So we go to the end of the hotel lobby, and he tells me the following story. He said 8 years earlier, he had a daughter who was born with a severe, severe developmental disability. He was told she would not only never talk and never understand, but that she would never even sit up. She spent her entire life laying down, not being able to communicate, not being able to really have that Ishel Reyehu that we've been talking about. So he said, When she was about 6 months old, he heard that there was a program in Europe where physical therapists, a certain percentage of time, are able to teach some of these kids, not all of them, to sit up. Figures it's worth a shot. He thinks to himself, you know, what could be a better way of giving his daughter some quality of life than to have her sit up? He figures even if it's not guaranteed, he'll go. Flies to Europe with his daughter. They start working on her. And it becomes clear that she might be a responder. But he runs out of money. He runs out of time. He's there for months. And he has to go back to his other kids, to his wife. And he begs them, teach me how to do this physical therapy. They say, you don't even have a high school diploma. We can't teach you this stuff. You need much more education than you have. But he was extremely persistent, as I learned this group of Hasidim could be. And he did not let go. And finally, they taught him the basics of the program. He says he flies back. He teaches his wife what he knew. And he spends the next 6 years or so, working with her to teach her how to sit up. Then he turns to me and says, do you mind if I introduce you to my daughter? I said, are you kidding? It's my pleasure. And he calls to a counselor at the other end of the hotel lobby. And they wheel over to me, sitting up, this 8-year-old girl who's clearly incredibly impaired, but she's sitting up. And she flashes us a million-dollar smile as the three of us, father, mother, and me, just are crying tears of happiness, tears of joy. Since then, I don't say Zokev Kafufim every morning the same way. I just don't. I have a different appreciation for something as simple as standing upright. Something as simple as looking face to face. And it's that appreciation for uniqueness, that appreciation for face-to-face, heart-to-heart, mirror neuron, bouncing off of mirror neuron, that I think is the key message that I think these parshios teach us, and the key message that I wanted to impart to you tonight. So thank you, everybody.